The Composer Series is sponsored by Eric Rath Music, found at ericrathmusic.com. Robert W. Smith is one of the most popular and prolific composers of our time. He writes for all kinds of ensembles and skill levels, and many note his great ability to write for younger bands. We talk about how he got started.
I was a young writer, and he looked at me and he said, "Robert, you know, you're going to be able to do this." He said, "But if I were you, I would start writing for the young group first and then just grow."
We talk about the vocabulary of music, his process of composing, and about his most popular pieces.
The anomaly for me, the one that never ceases to amaze me, is actually a beginning band piece.
Think you know which composition he's referring to? Find out on this podcast. Plus, hear a discussion about his quest for new percussion sounds. All of this and more as we talk with Robert W. Smith on the Marching Roundtable. This podcast is sponsored by Eric Rath Music, found at ericrathmusic.com. With marching shows for every size and ability level, as well as fully integrated percussion scoring, Eric Rath Music provides one-stop shopping for your band program. From La Fiesta Mexicana to the Great Locomotive Chase to original and public domain shows, there's something for everybody. Log on to the all-new ericrathmusic.com. That's ericrathmusic.com. To hear shows that are available for sale, and to see what people are saying.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Marching Roundtable. This is Tim Hinton with me tonight. Dr. Joe Allison, how are you, Joe?
I am great, and I'm really thrilled to be here with our special guest because, to me, he's a very special person.
Absolutely. Robert W. Smith is with us. Robert, how are you?
I am fine. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here today. Now, Joe, were you out chopping down trees and stuff? Is that what you were just doing?
Oh, don't tell everything, you know. We've had a couple of ice storms and wind storms here in Kentucky, and I've got several trees down. So I was actually out with a contractor trying to figure out which things we could get down and which we need to leave up, and I tripped and fell three or four times, and it was great.
I was afraid that your story was going to involve a chainsaw, and that's where I was getting worried.
Oh, God, I have one, and it's just like I alert the neighbors anytime I start it up.
Well, Robert, does that alert you? I know you've known Joe a long time.
I've known Joe a very long time. So, actually, with Joe, nothing surprises me.
There you go.
Well, I thought that might be the case. And Robert, you live in Florida, where I live, right?
Yes. Seems like such a simple question, but it's not so simple an answer. Yes, I live in Florida. I live in Navarre, Florida. However, a few years ago, we got hurricane. We're one of those people you saw on TV.
Wow.
I'm talking to you from Alabama. We were there and going through the hurricane aftermath, lost our home, all that kind of stuff. Relocated up to Montgomery, Alabama, about 3 hours north, which is actually very close to where I was born and raised. So we got such a great thing going here. My wife is a very fine band director, and she's teaching in a school called the St. James School. And my daughter's going through that really great academic program, and she built a band. And so we decided we would stay here until our youngest graduates, and that is going to be actually here in just a few weeks when we finally empty nest. So,
well,
God, I'm old. I'm so old. Savannah's in college and Madison's graduating.
Absolutely. Here we go.
Well, and you know, it's ridiculous that I was even thinking Florida. I think of you as a Florida person, I guess, but I have right here in front of me that you've been teaching at Troy University, right? So that would make sense. I doubt you would be commuting all the way up from.
Correct. Well, actually, for 1 year, I had taken a position. I used to be the director of bands at Troy, and then left. I have such a great group of colleagues and great students at Troy, but I had one of those opportunities you couldn't turn down. So I was working for Warner Brothers on a project for about 5 years, and then had the opportunity to go back to Troy. And they configured my schedule in such a way that I actually, until the hurricane, I was commuting up. I'm teaching Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and then working from the office and visiting students on Mondays and Fridays kind of thing. However, the hurricane kind of changed all that, and so now I'm living in Montgomery, Alabama. I live in my second home and vacation in my primary home, if that makes any sense. So.
It does. And it's also the moral of the story, Tim, is that Robert is worth any trouble you want to go to have him work for you.
Well,
there you go. And I think we already knew that. and that's very exciting to have the two homes, and you can go down to Florida when you want to. And that sounds wonderful. And Robert, you're such an incredibly prolific composer. I mean, over 700 publications in print. That just actually doesn't seem possible. Do you like toss out two in the morning and another in the evening, or?
Not necessarily. No, I don't toss them out of the morning. It's just, it's,
you wait, know, wait, I wasn't making any inference that your music sounded like you tossed it off. I don't want you to think that. That's the last thing I'm saying.
I've written plenty of tossable tunes, that's for sure. But to use a line from Billy Crystal in a movie, you know, he's a writer writes, and that's just who I am. It's not a job, it's a life. So you're right.
Yeah,
and then also too, many of those compositions, I learned, my first composition teacher was Paul Yoder. You may have some listeners that may be old enough to remember who Paul Yoder was.
Sure.
And he actually had over 1,200 in his career. So I pale by comparison to my first comp teacher. But it spread out over, take a cue from him, it spread out over multiple levels and multiple genres and multiple types of ensembles. So, beginners all the way to pros for band and orchestra, rhythm section type groups, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's actually what I think is really, really interesting is I don't think a lot of people know that you have written for all these different levels of groups. And I find that to be quite remarkable. I mean, I think that, I don't think it's kind of hard, Joe. I guess I should ask Robert, but it seems to me writing for a young, very, very young band and writing for an orchestra, this is like two completely different animals, right?
Well, yeah. Remember what John Mackey told me in that interview, that he found out he wasn't good enough to write for young bands the first time he tried, and all the parameters and whatnot, it really is a special skill.
All the restrictions. And you're so great at it, Robert. Like, not to jump ahead, but like, what's your secret there? Because you write such great music for young groups. I think that's so hard.
Well, I go back again to Paul Yoder. He looked at me. I was a young writer, and he looked at me and he said, "Robert, you know, yes, you're going to be able to do this." He said, "But, you know, if I were you, I would start writing for the young group first, and then just grow with your audience." And I can never, ever, ever repay him for that, because it gave me a different perspective, when I'm a 19, 20 year old writer, and just gave me a completely different perspective. I would agree with Mr. Mackey. It's actually tougher to write a good piece of music for a young group than it is for a professional group. No restrictions on the professional, just make it sound good. But the young kids, in addition to the limited musical abilities and musical fodder to work with, also too, they have to be engaged, so they have to play. So too many rests, and they're not. There's no educational value there, little educational value. So it's a little bit different kind of puzzle. But thankfully, I had a gentleman who introduced me to that many, many years ago, and I'm forever, forever grateful.
Yeah, Tim, the thing that captures me about a lot of Robert's music, and I still do a good bit of it, particularly in clinics and whatnot, is the level of imagination is extreme. The parameters may be there technically, but the imagination and the passion and the creativity is still there.
Well, right. And I can't tell you, I mean, well, everybody knows this. Young band members love playing his tunes because there's all this energy in the rhythms. And like he said, everybody's being engaged. I think that's really, really hard. Robert, can you speak more to that phenomenon you mentioned about getting a different perspective by starting writing for young bands? What was different about that that you don't think other composers maybe have?
Well, a lot of it had to do, and you hit on it, a lot of it had to do with making sure that students were excited about the rehearsal, excited about their performance. The end result, the music is so very, very important, and that's what the audience hears. But the reality is, for the piece to have depth, you have to look at it also from the individual chair, the individual student's chair out, and their individual line.
Right.
You know, I learned from Dr. Yoder. I learned I got my master's degree in a program at the University of Miami with Alfred Reed. You know, and both of those gentlemen, just amazing, amazing teachers as well. You know, after you've written this, Robert, get down and sit down in that chair and be the flute player and be the horn player and be the clarinet player and read every individual line and make sure it's something that people are going to be engaged. If the students are engaged, if the musicians are engaged, and the overall musical statement is solid, then it's going to be a total artistic experience for performer and audience alike.
Wow. I love
it. Pretty good, huh?
That's fantastic. Well, also, don't you think that a lot of young band pieces are supposed to be teaching them skills or rhythms or something musical. Do you have that in your head as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. We, you know, using a grade level system, and our, in the United States, this country, we're close, but we don't necessarily agree on grading. We're close, but we can say, let's call it a 1 to 6 grade, grading scale. There's certain benchmarks. There's certain musical, fundamentals that have to be addressed at certain times, in their development in order for them to turn into, the very solid musician we want them to be. In our country, what is very different about the United States, is that we teach from the ensemble perspective. We teach classes, particularly at the young grade levels. You know, we're teaching classes of 100 beginners at once. And that's really, if you think about it, the enormity of that's almost crazy. We've got 100 children playing 3 different families of instruments in 100 different ways, and we're trying to teach in 30 minutes and turn it into a band. Other countries in the world, they teach individual students. It's one-on-one. And then the band or the orchestra or the choir, the ensemble, that's a supplemental reinforcing enrichment kind of experience. That might be once a week, maybe twice a week as they're getting close to the concert. In America, we do it differently. So unless there's a sequenced approach, we're going to learn this particular skill, this articulation, this finger combination. Unless there's a sequenced approach to that, our ensemble system really wouldn't work. So there's a lot that goes into it.
So you're thinking about that, obviously, as well as engaging them, as well as making it enjoyable to the audience. Okay, Joe, we've established that Robert is a genius. Where do we go from here? I mean,
Well, first of all, I was going to say, yeah, the Europeans think we're crazy for trying to, but that's just such a quintessential American characteristic that we do it that way. I would equate it to a Rubik's Cube the way that he and others have to ride. And again, I know I'm starting to be redundant, but having taught younger children at some point in my career, it's just the music, the printed music is so much in our situations. The music is the curriculum, and Robert's things just, they're even engaging for the conductor. I mean, you know, you're talking about a 25, 30, 35 year old conductor lots of times with those young bands. And sometimes, you know, you can fall asleep on the podium when you're rehearsing this stuff, but there's always elements to it that keep it fresh for everyone. I don't know how he does it. And even if he only wrote 15 pieces, I don't know how he does it. So. Well, I just think it's amazing.
Well, that's the other thing is that when a composer is this prolific, well, I'll ask you, Robert, how do you keep from repeating yourself? Like, you know, there are only so many rhythms that a grade 3 band can play, and there are only so much range to the instrument. I know that's what the genius of being a great composer is, but do you have any insight into that for people listening?
Yeah, that's a really great question, one that I'm not really asked that often. Over the years, I've had interesting experiences on that subject line. If you're studying composition at college, in a college setting or studying formally, you know, they want you not to repeat yourself. They want everything to be new all the time. It was not too long down that path that I realized, and was reminded that music is a language. It is truly the universal language. If everything that we spoke was brand new, nobody would understand us.
You're here.
There's a vocabulary.
No, Robert, forgive me for interrupting you. If everything was brand new, it would be like the CBDNA convention. You can't say that, but I can. Tim, what I'm referring to is that so often there's all these new works and exotic vocabularies and whatnot, and there's not necessarily that balance of the familiar and the extravagance. So, well, there's lots of extravagance, but that balance between the familiar and the not so familiar.
I was reminded, and it was a very strong, stark realization at that moment that, wait a minute, you know, we have to draw upon what people know in order to truly be able to communicate with them without necessarily just repeating ourselves. So if we treat music like a vocabulary and then find unique ways to apply that vocabulary, that may be, we'll call it the safest way to ensure communication between musician and audience. Now, there was a couple times in my life where I pushed the envelope. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it immensely, but I also lost the audience. So I can speak from experience that it's a very thin edge when you're developing. When I'm explaining this to my students, those that are studying writing and composition with me, you know, if you take let's use the movies. If there's an actor that you happen to like, there are certain things about that actor. There are certain phrases, there are certain looks, body language, nonverbal language that you like about that actor. And you want that to be consistent in that actor's films from the film performances from film to film. If you go too far, if you have somebody that is a really wonderful comedian and all of a sudden they're doing, Shakespeare and they're doing Hamlet, and it is so serious, it breaks that what people have come to love about them, that could necessarily not be the, shall we call it, the most positive presentation. So it's a very careful and strategic process in order to not repeat, but at the same time still be able to communicate with the listener.
Tim, I remember having a conversation years and years ago with the composer Robert Jager, and one of the things that I'll never forget from that conversation was he was always sort of torn because one of the marketing criticisms of his work was that no two of his pieces sounded the same. And as a matter of fact, things like the Third Suite and Esprit de Corps, you'd never know that they were the same composer. Hmm. And so he actually felt like he was maybe unfairly misjudged on the opposite side of the fence because he did have so much variety in his work. So what Robert says really resonates when it comes to that. Just like Goldilocks says, just enough to be just right. But
there we go.
Yeah.
Well, right. And when you hear Tchaikovsky, you know it's Tchaikovsky, but it's not all the same tunes. But, you know, that sounds like Tchaikovsky. And I think that's true of Robert's work very much. I think when we hear it, you know, where, oh, that's one of those great Robert W. Smith tunes, and it sounds like him, but I think that's a tricky balance you have to find, Robert, as you're writing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we all have, there's a musical DNA, there's a personality that develops in anybody who creates. And, I learned, you know, for example, from Alfred Reed, you know, scoring, he was a master.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and just, you can sustain a chord and say that Alfred Reed did that, you know, and it had to do with the voicing. So there's so much to it in terms of, you know, voicing, harmonic language. And as I grow, the great thing about getting older is, you experience so many more things. And so your tools of expression begin to not change, but they begin to expand. I like the idea of expansion as opposed to changing, because oftentimes you want to go back and grab a trusted tool in order to say just the right thing at just the right moment.
So you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but if you're used to having these parameters and this vocabulary, when you suddenly have a professional group, you know, you're writing for the U.S. Navy band or an orchestra or, you know, whatever, do you find that is difficult because their parameters aren't there?
For me, no. That's the easiest and perhaps the most creatively fun to write. I enjoy the puzzle. I enjoy the Rubik's Cube, as Joe mentioned earlier. And I enjoy that process. But I got to tell you, when I'm writing for a very fine professional group, it's all about what one is trying to say and trying to convey something that is so wonderful and brand new. So there's a freedom in that I truly do enjoy. By the way, through that's almost research and development for me. You know, I'll stumble onto new things, stumble onto things that, extending my creative palette, another inch or two forward. And from that comes, lots of other ideas that, spawn from that maybe go back into the educational works. So I really do love that process.
Well, it's great.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I'm having the best time. Robert, thank you so much for being here. We told on Facebook, we often will tell people, okay, you know, this week we're talking to so-and-so. What would you like them to ask us? So I have this giant list of things that people wanted to ask you. I won't make you answer them all. But since we're talking about your creative process for composing, Dave wants to know, do you do lots of drafting and revision? I would like to know what your process is. Are you typing the notes directly into the computer? Some people write by hand first and then transfer it. I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's a great question. Dave, thanks for sending that in. Things have shifted over the years. My creative processes have not changed. However, the way it manifests itself has changed based upon technology. At my age, as of, you know, right now I'm 55 years old, the personal computer was not invented till I was already an adult. So technology has had a significant impact on my life. Even then, after adopting a personal computer and going through every possible music engraving notation program, I still found that I could do it faster by hand and more effectively by hand. Up until 93, 94, and it had to do with the release of Finale 3.5 and the Quadra 840 AV, that one Apple computer. And for the very first time, I could actually do it faster in the machine. Now, here we go, all these years later, literally 20 years since that point, I almost can't imagine doing it by hand anymore because it's one with the machine. So my process, I write mentally. I, you know, it's a process. I hear the colors, I hear the lines, I hear the interaction, and I literally just simply sit down office desk and at a keyboard here with my computer screen in front of me and just start playing it into the machine. I start then by, in the first phase of that is really just doing a sketch score. I'll do five, maybe six lines depending upon the complexity of the piece. And I'll start and go left to right. I will get the creative work done as cleanly and as completely as possible. Once I'm really comfortable with that, then I'll expand that score vertically into the full band, the orchestra, whatever the ensemble happens to be. The creative work for me is, you know, it's time sensitive. I like no distractions. In fact, my office is in a separate building at my home, and so I can walk out into the room I'm sitting at right now, and I'm not bothering anybody, and nobody's bothering me. So the travel schedule of my life is so intense that I schedule the creative work when I'm home, and I schedule the creative work. I get as many things done as possible. Then when I'm in a hotel sitting somewhere at night and I've got an hour, I can go back and orchestrate and pick up right where I left off without having to worry about reclaiming my creative thought. So that's kind of a long-winded, hopefully somewhat brief answer to your question.
It's an interesting answer. I know that.
I love that. When you're taking the six line score and you're expanding it, do you simply take that score and add a bunch of staves and expand it? Or do you take those lines and then transfer them to a different score that has the entire instrumentation on it?
Notation programs now have a unique ability to be able to hide staves.
Right. Right.
So start with a full score ensemble. I hide all the staves that I'm not going to use and decide what I'm going to sketch on. I'll sketch there. Then I'll open back up those empty staves, and then you have the ability to explode. Let's say if I'm writing a trumpet part, I write all three, let's say three trumpet parts. I write all three on the first trumpet line. Once the creative work is done, then I'll open up the remaining trumpets and go ahead and explode that onto three staves, you know, get all the articulations, dynamics, things along those lines that need to be transferred. And then just work at it vertically, section by section.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. That's great. Dave also asked, how do you know when it works or when it needs more tweaking? Like, when you're, do you do a lot of tweaking once it's out there?
Yes. Well, actually, once it's out there, depends on the state of what out there is.
Right.
If it's going to print, out there really is up to the recording session. And once it gets into print, the only tweaks that happen thereafter are really just corrections, maybe a missed accidental or something on those lines, and that'll get corrected in a printing. What I really love to do, more than anything else, is I love to go through the commission process, you know, particularly when it's something that I can publish. I love the idea of writing and collaborating with a conductor, working with them and their group, actually going through the premiere process, then come back and tweak, and then take it to print. That's the best of all scenarios for me. But significant, if you're a professional writer, professional composer, a lot of times you're doing it, and what comes out is what is actually ends out there. So the tweaking process is a luxury. If you're writing in some areas, let's take drum corps, for example. You know, we spend all summer tweaking. And we're tweaking for lots of reasons, trying to kind of like a tailor who's nipping and tucking at the suit just to make sure it finally fits in every conceivable way. Unfortunately there, I find that sometimes the composition process becomes decomposition. So Thing versus decomposing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm definitely going to ask you about drum corps. Before we move away to there, Timothy asked if you had a favorite work. I mean, he started, you know, listing the ones he loves, 12 Seconds to the Moon, Nation of Strength, Songs of Sailor and Sea, et cetera, the symphonies, of course. Do you have a favorite or some favorites you'd like to share?
You know, everyone that you just mentioned, I'll call those in a list of favorites because, you know, you write a piece of music, it's out there, you know, you can publish something and it's going to have a life of a year, two, three, four. But when I look at some of those works, that I wrote literally 20 years ago and they still are, you know, they're getting played actually more now than they did when they came out the first year, those end up being favorites. And I'm not sure, favorite might even be the right word. I'll call it a blessing. I'll call it, I'm really you had a creative thought that actually was of value that now, literally a generation later, it's still here and alive. The one that the anomaly for me, the one that never ceases to amaze me, is actually a beginning band piece. I wrote a piece called The Tempest, and I literally did that over 20 years ago. And, countless thousands of groups play that every single year. It sells sets, four and part sets, you know, in the four figures every single year.
Yeah, I hear it at concert festivals every spring, Robert.
And there's still something about it. I was reminded yesterday, my wife, she pulled it out for her sixth grade band and they're playing it. And the sixth graders just love it, you know. If there's a platinum hit that I've written, it's called The Tempest, because millions and millions of young musicians have played it. The strange thing now, though, is I'm traveling and you'll have a musician 35 to 40 years old who comes up going, I love The Tempest. You know? That's a professional musician and adult. So that's kind of a strange thing.
Robert, while we're on the subject, seems like at one point I heard that The Great Locomotive Chase was maybe the most played piece of yours or ever.
It's up there. It's certainly near the top. I don't think it's eclipsed The Tempest, but it's certainly in the top two or three.
Yeah. And for good reason.
That one, using some different kinds of sounds and then the programmatic tie to American history, the kids get really excited about that particular piece. Kids of all ages. That gets played quite a bit.
Yeah, great. Now, Robert asked, what's it like to have perfect pitch? How has it affected your life?
It depends on the age and the context. As a kid, I just didn't realize that everybody couldn't hear that. I thought it was just a sense like touch and smell and taste. So I just didn't know. Although when I started taking piano, I started music lessons when I was five. It was literally the day I turned five. My mom and my grandmother were both keyboard players. My grandmother, may she rest in peace, we just lost her last year. She was a few weeks shy of her 102nd birthday.
Wow.
She was taught organist, and I used to sit there and go to church and listen to her play. And some of my fondest memories is actually playing Sunday morning services, and I'm on trumpet, she's on the piano or organ. It's amazing. But I was a little bitty guy. I was 3 years old, and I wanted to play piano. And my mom was trying to get the local piano teacher to take me. She said, "No, I'll take him when he's five." Well, October the 24th, in my fifth year of life, I showed up on her. And said I'm five, so you start putting then note names, and it's like colors, we can all see a color, but you're not quite sure what label to put on it. So that was an interesting experience. And then you're at a birthday party, for example, and they start singing happy birthday in F sharp major, and trying to do all the note names, so that it affected me greatly there. Perfect pitch has got its benefits. It's got its hindrances. Sometimes it's a hindrance. Sometimes you just want to sit back and not analyze technically. You just want to sit back and absorb. That's interesting. When ensembles, particularly in modern day, when we have the ability with electronic instruments to kind of detune just a bit, it does become a little bit of a hindrance there when pitch centers don't really line up with our sense of equal temperament based upon A440, or non-equal temperament. based on A440. So that sometimes gets a little frustrating because you're trying to find the label that's the pitch center, and it's sitting somewhere between, you know, functioning half steps. So that's sometimes a problem. But overall, it's a bit of a blessing and a little bit of a curse.
Wow, great. And then David asked a question that we ask a lot of composers and arrangers, and I won't ask you to give a long answer unless you just want to, but everybody that is a young arranger or composer always wants advice. You know, like, do you have suggestions for them as they're trying to develop and start their career or continue their career? So any brief suggestions for those people that are listening?
Oh, absolutely. First off, writing is an art, but writing is also a craft. And so the advice I would give now is actually different than advice I would give 20 years ago. The art of writing used to be write, think, notate, score it, pencil it out, get it out, and try and get it played as much as possible, because the objective then was to get the sounds in your ears. You had to, I was talking about labels, you know, the perfect pitch question. You know, you had to look at this, you know, create this piece of paper, and then you had to associate sounds and timbres, and so to get it read for the first time and hear what you did well and what you didn't do well was so very important. I can never thank enough my high school band director, Dr. Clifford M. Winter, who literally played everything. I'm in eighth grade and I'm writing and I bring it in and he would play it. Within a day, he would play it. So being able to that process for me was so very important. The problem now, 2014, is that we've got computer applications, Finale, Sibelius. We have sound libraries, sample libraries, and we can make it all sound great in a computer. The problem is it does not translate into the acoustic world. One of my laments is we may be losing the art of orchestration in an acoustic environment. It sounds great in a computer, and then young writers are not quite sure why it didn't sound sound that good when it's, played by a live ensemble. And so I would really encourage them to, explore the art of musical composition, but also make sure you explore the craft and understand how that's going to translate back into the acoustic realm. I'm reminded that audio engineers will know exactly what I'm talking about, but that works as well for composers. I'm reminded of a 3-to-1 rule. It takes 3 strings to equal 1 woodwind, in terms of strength. It takes 3 woodwinds to equal a brass. It takes 3 brass to equal 1 percussionist. And if you go back to Beethoven's original concept behind this full symphony orchestra, you'll actually see that 3-to-1 rule in place. So let's not forget that as we continue down the digital road.
And that was before Kevlar, too. Isn't that brilliant, Tim?
Yeah, I love it. That was great. Well, Joe, did you have anything you wanted to ask him about concert before we start talking about marching stuff?
I actually do. Robert, do you still have some sort of policy or practice of searching out very unique percussion instruments for your compositions?
Absolutely.
Because we explained that to me one time in Ireland, and I was fascinated. Would you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. I'd love to. You look at, let's say, a band or an orchestra, and with little exception, there's only so many sounds you're going to get out of a string, a woodwind, a brass. There's only so many sounds. Yeah, we can put a mute in. We can maybe try a slightly different playing technique, but it's still a very limited color palette. However, the world of percussion is absolutely unlimited. There's really only 3 instruments that are used in every culture in the world. One is voice, the human voice. The second one is the flute. Flutes are made of different materials. It could be a wooden flute, but in Asia, it could be a metal flute. In Central Europe, it could be a different thing when it comes down in Ireland. And Joe mentioned Ireland. The penny whistle is a flute, or an Irish flute is going to be made of a different type of material. But percussion is used in every culture of the world, and percussionists use the indigenous materials in order to make these instruments. So different types of woods, different types of materials, different types of heads, and different types of playing styles create a unbelievably wide sound palette. And as a composer, for me, percussion not only is a heartbeat, it gives life to the music, but let's be a chef for a second. That becomes the spice. that becomes the thing that really makes this musical dish taste just amazing. You know, you get good quality ingredients, with brass, woodwinds, percussion strings, but spice it with percussion, and you've got something very, very unique. So every time I go, I'm fortunate enough to travel literally around the world. I'll be overseas, even at this point, I'll be overseas about a month of this year, in different locations. And so every time I go somewhere, I always start searching for instruments, new sounds. And more often than not, that ends up being in the percussion family. So I will collect those. I collect those sounds. And just like a chef would put spices in the cabinet, and then at the appropriate time, pull that spice out and use it. And I love using it when we're dealing in music of that particular culture. But what I love even more is to take that sound and mix it, fuse it with things from another culture and create something brand new. I find that process fascinating.
Wow, fantastic. Thank you for explaining that. That's great. Another way to keep those kids engaged, too.
Absolutely. You know, the percussionists, there's just something about the psychological profile of a percussionist. We'll try anything. They're like Mikey and the syrup. If you're old enough to remember, the life. Well, give it to Mikey, he'll eat it. Give it to the percussionist. They will play it. They think twice about it.
Yeah, very cool.
We continue our conversation with Robert on the next podcast when we talk about his work with marching groups, including how he got started, the stories from his days with the Suncoast Sound, and more recently with the Madison Scouts and the Troopers. Thanks again to our sponsor, Eric Rath Music, found at ericrathmusic.com. Thanks to our editor, Aaron Osborne. And thanks again to Robert for joining us. And thanks to you for listening. If you're a business that works with band directors, marching bands, color guards, or drum lines, you should consider sponsoring an episode of the Marching Roundtable. Our listeners are the exact audience you're trying to reach, and with thousands of podcast downloads each month, it's a great way to directly reach your target audience. For more information, click on the Sponsorship Opportunities link at marchingroundtable.com or email Tim at tim@marchingroundtable.com. You can grow your business and help support what we're doing here on the podcast. Thanks.